This is WPFP AM Park Falls, a Civic Media radio station.
Mas try carrying the weight of the world, but I only have two hands. Hope I get the chance to travel the world, but I don't have any plans. Wish that I could stay forever this young, not afraid to close my eyes. Life's a game made for everyone, and love is the prize. So wake me up when it's all over, when I'm wiser and I'm older. All this time I was finding myself, and I didn't know I was lost. So wake me up.
Is 103.1 FM.
All right.
103.1 FM.
This week on Viewpoints.
She was very glad that the Civil War ended when it did because the slaveholders were about to put her three-year-old boy into the field, and she just wrote, "They took them young."
We take a look at the stark portraits of those born into slavery. Then,
I found myself caring so much and getting so upset that I called my sister and I said, "What is happening to me?"
Ever get so worked up while watching your kid play sports? You're not alone. I'm Marty Peterson.
And I'm Gary Price. These stories in depth this week on your public affairs magazine, Viewpoints.
$5 won't get you much food these days, even on a value menu, unless you're at KFC. With the new taste of KFC deals, you can get a hot, juicy Drummond thigh, creamy mashed potatoes and gravy, and a flaky, buttery biscuit starting at just $4.99. Son of a bucket, that's a good deal. The new taste of KFC deals starting at just $4.99. It's finger-licking good. Prices, participation, and product offering may vary. Tax, tip, and fees extra.
The Radio Health Journal podcast gives listeners the latest news on what's trending in health, science, technology, and more.
Certainly, we all want to see suicide prevention, and I'm certain that it does work to a degree. It's when I hear that all suicides are preventable that it makes me bristle, because they are not.
Featuring medical experts who break down complex topics in a way that's easy to understand. Radio Health Journal podcast, available wherever you find your favorite podcasts and at radiohealthjournal.org.
As the bloody Civil War came to a close, slavery was formally abolished in the U.S. in 1865. With this amendment, many African Americans who were born into slavery in the South were free for the first time in their lives. Richard Toler was among this group. He was born around 1837 on a plantation in Lynchburg, Virginia. After the war, he went on to work as a blacksmith, stonemason, and carpenter, according to interview excerpts gathered by the Federal Writers Project.
It's a firsthand look at slavery. You know, we all learn about slavery, or most of us learn about slavery in schools and in high school, and it's oftentimes kind of couched in economic and political terms, but this is the first time I'd ever come across firsthand accounts, and I think that's its real value.
That's Richard Cahan, co-author of the book River of Blood, American Slavery from the People Who Lived It. The new release chronicles nearly 100 profiles of those that had been enslaved in the South. Each profile features a photo and a short excerpt from an interview with that person conducted by the Federal Writers Project during the late 1930s. The project was created by the federal government after the Civil War in an effort to capture the raw experiences of those formerly enslaved.
So this was about 70 years after the end of the Civil War, and the people that were interviewed were at least 70 if they were babies, but they were in their 80s and 90s, and even some were 100 years old, and they talked about their experiences and their thoughts. And one thing that's very unusual about this book is that we've used photographs, portraits of formerly enslaved people to go with their words so that you really get a sense of the power of their words and their pictures together.
The dozens of writers that made up the Federal Writers Project interviewed nearly 3,000 formerly enslaved men and women.
Most of the interviewers and most of the interviewer/photographers were white. And here these people were being asked by white people for the first time in their lives what they felt like, what they experienced. They were being honored and valued. And then at the end of this interview, they were being asked to pose for photographs. And I think that many of the 96 people who are on the book really took this moment to make a statement about their resilience and their pride. So many of them are pictured in, men were pictured in suits, but on the whole, people were just wearing what they were wearing. But they're always sitting up ramrod straight, or even if they have a cane, they're standing very stately. And I think they somehow, and I don't know how, understood the importance of both giving their testimony, which was essential, and being photographed.
One of the women interviewed and photographed was Mary Ann Burleson Patterson. She was born into slavery around 1840 in Louisiana and forcibly relocated to Texas after her and her mother were both sold to a slaveholder near Austin. At the time of her interview, she said that she doesn't know exactly how old she is, but she could be anywhere between 97 to 102 years old.
That picture of Marian Burleson Patterson, it's a woman just standing with a hoe in front of her, and she's got on a long apron and very beautiful dress, and not dress, but work clothes. And she was born around 1840, so when she was interviewed, she was very close to 100 years old, and she's still hoeing the land.
Despite the horrors and hardships of slavery, Burleson Patterson went on to marry and raised 15 children on her family's farm. The Federal Writers Project found so many stories similar to hers, stories of resilience, strength, and the will to start over again.
This one woman, Betty Simmons, was talking about how she was very glad that the Civil War ended when it did because the slaveholders were about to put her three-year-old boy into the field, and she just wrote, "They took them young." And Felix Haywood, another person, talked about how some African Americans, a few of them, most people stayed on the plantations, but a few wanted to move north. His words are so brilliant. He just wrote, "They seemed to want to get closer to freedom so they'd know what it was, like it was a place or a city."
Many who were formerly enslaved remained in the South after the end of the Civil War and tried to find work nearby.
They had to start their new lives with absolutely nothing. And obviously, with in the South especially, so much hatred directed towards them. The end of the war was a very difficult moment for African Americans who had been enslaved. Very few could read or write because they were prohibited from reading and from owning writing instruments. And they weren't equipped to do much more than to live a life on a farm, a hardworking life on a farm. So at the end of the war, it was not surprising that many people, most people, stayed close to the plantation where they had been held or nearby, because oftentimes slaveholders agreed to pay them. It was a very small amount of money, but they agreed to pay them and also provide for their food and their housing. And it was a difficult choice to stay, I'm sure, on plantations, but I think that it was a choice that many people saw as a practical choice, especially after the first couple of years at the end of the Civil War.
But by the early 1900s, thousands started migrating north to cities including Chicago, Detroit, and New York in search of greater opportunities. They pushed onward in hopes of a better tomorrow. These words and portraits gathered from formerly enslaved men and women and cemented in history are vital to remembering this dark period in American history. To see some of the photos featured in the book River of Blood, American Slavery from the People Who Lived It, visit viewpointsradio.org. For more behind the scenes, check out Viewpoints Radio on Instagram, X, and Facebook. This segment originally aired in February 2020 and was written and produced by Amira Zaveri. Our studio manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Gary Price.
Coming up, the emotional roller coaster of youth sports when Viewpoints returns.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
What do you do about car trouble? Call Dad? Why not give him a break this Father's Day and visit AutoZone instead? If it's a battery problem, AutoZone has free battery testing and charging and battery options as low as $89.99. And right now, you can save at the AutoZone Father's Day sale through June 16th. Give Dad a break and maybe get him something too at AutoZone.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Restrictions apply.
The Radio Health Journal podcast gives listeners the latest news on what's trending in health, science, technology, and more.
Why are certain providers and medical doctors not listening to family members who have lived through a disease path for such a long time?
Featuring medical experts who break down complex topics in a way that's easy to understand. Radio Health Journal podcast, available wherever you find your favorite podcasts and at radiohealthjournal.org.
$5 won't get you much food these days, even on a value menu. unless you're at KFC. With the new taste of KFC deals, you can get a hot, juicy Drummond thigh, creamy mashed potatoes and gravy, and a flaky, buttery biscuit starting at just $4.99. Son of a bucket, that's a good deal. The new taste of KFC deals starting at just $4.99. It's finger-licking good. Prices, participation, and product offering may vary. Tax, tip, and fees extra.
Whether you own a local business or a global one, you're always looking for ways to position your operation to create opportunities and move on them faster. With Bank of America, you get access to experts, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter, locally and globally. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Copyright 2024 Bank of America N.A.
There's no denying that we, as Americans, love watching sports. Whether it's baseball, hockey, basketball, soccer, or something else, we love an afternoon spent rooting for our team. If you're a parent and your child plays sports, you might be equally excited to root for your kid from the stands. After all, the world of youth sports can get extremely competitive. For some families, it's full of high stakes, big commitments, and can often feel like the highest highs and the lowest lows. And while it's great to show support and enthusiasm as parents, this drive to win can become all-consuming. You may be familiar with the mom or dad hovering on the sidelines and yelling at their kid or the referee, and in the moment thought, what is wrong with that person?
If you know me, I'm a very laid-back person. And I don't care that much about very many things. And I kind of tend to live by the Bill Murray maxim from the movie Meatballs, which is it just doesn't matter. But when my kid started playing hockey and getting pretty competitive about it, something happened to me that I didn't understand. It's kind of like the Hulk, you know? I started to change. And I was like, what the hell is going on?
That's Rich Cohen, a hockey dad and author of Pee-wee's Confessions of a Hockey Parent.
You cannot be objective about your kid. And that doesn't mean you always think your kid is the best. It also means you might think your kid is the worst. I always broke parents, hockey parents, sports parents, parents in general, into two kinds of groups. The one that could only see what their kid does right and can't see what their kid does wrong, and the one that can only see what their kid does wrong and can't see what their kid does right. And it's impossible to look at your child as if your child is not attached to you or is a stranger to you. And you might think you're doing it, but it can't be done.
In the book, he follows the ups and downs of being involved in his son's traveling hockey team, all the way from tryouts to the coveted end-of-the-season championship game.
During the whole process of tryouts, when he was a peewee, things were going on that seemed wrong to me and not fair, and I found myself caring so much and getting so upset that I called my sister and I said, what is happening to me? She's old, my big sister, and she has four kids. And she said, when something wrong is happening with your kids, it's not just like it's something you care about or something happening to someone's close to you. It's like it is you. That's what it feels like. And that's what I realized, which is with my son, I was going through all these things that I had gone through as a kid without even aware what was happening again.
Cohen grew up in the suburbs of Chicago and also played ice hockey when he was a kid. But he says the sport these days is drastically different from what it was back then, and not for the better. One thing that's completely changed, team tryouts.
They have these outside evaluators, and they come in and for tryouts, and they do two things. One is they judge the kids who are trying out on things that can be measured. So you can only judge on what can be measured, which is like speed, how sharply you turn, how you are on your inside edges, your outside edges, all these specific things to hockey that you can measure. And if you can't measure it, it's like it doesn't exist. And you see this in sports and society in general with testing, with the way people are judged, which is the most important things can't be measured. And so it's like they don't exist, and those kids who are the best often get left behind because you can only tell, you can only find those things much later, like at the end of a long tournament, in the fifth game, when your team is already eliminated but they're playing, which kid is still trying? Which kid is still out there working?
Qualities like perseverance, grit, and growth are often overlooked because outside evaluators are judging the kids based off what they see in the moment. Essentially, these people act as a buffer between the coach and the players.
The outside evaluators give the system, whatever the system is, a degree of plausible deniability, which is if you're a parent, you complain, they say, hey, it wasn't me. I didn't make the decision. It was made objectively by these outside evaluators.
Another modification is the role of private trainers. Parents will hire these expensive professionals, hoping that the extra coaching will boost their child's chances of getting picked. Cohen believes it unfairly tips the scale in favor of kids who come from money.
Normally, when I was a kid, or just not that long ago, you'd sign your kid up, your kid had a coach, the coach did the tryouts, chose the team, coached the kid. Now, you say, look, my kid's not being developed. They say, maybe you should go hire an outside instructor. And you find out that all of these kids also have their own private trainers, which they're kind of using without telling the other kids because everyone's competing against each other. And all these things that were included now, you have to pay for extra. Some kids get it. Some kids don't. Some kids don't even know what's going on. And the fact is, the kids that are truly gifted and want to do this, doesn't matter. They're going to do their thing and they're going to get through. But the kids who really can use the instruction, who aren't clued into the system or whose parents aren't involved, are going to get left behind. And that's what I mean by the system breaking down.
For Cohen, the ultra-competitive nature of peewee hockey and many other youth sports has sucked up the joy of the game and replaced it with compulsive practice. Too often, parents try to fill in their children's schedules with mandatory ice time, hoping that the more hours they practice under guidance, the better they'll become. But whatever happened to the joy of playing sports as a kid?
When we were growing up, and you know, and the way people played hockey, just as one example forever, is you were practicing without knowing you were practicing. You were calling it playing. So in Glencoe, they would freeze over our park in the middle of town. You'd have like 8 or 9 games going simultaneously in the winter. They just pour water on it. And we'd be playing from basically till we can get outside until the sun went down. Now, that would be among the 10,000 hours of practicing, but we didn't consider it that, and that's why we were able to do it.
Today, there are several helicopter hockey parents who try to outsmart the system so that their child has a leg up.
When I was growing up, the idea was if you were good, they would have you play with older kids. This idea is that if you want to get good, you play with younger kids. And as a result of that, a lot of parents more and more have tried to hold their kids back to play with younger kids to build their confidence and get more coaching. And that is a big change that I saw, which is the idea that what does it take to be better? Does it take to play with bigger people, better people, faster people, or should you put yourself in a situation where you're kind of a ringer? And those things, the amount of practice and the sort of very carefully placing your kid in a system where they can play a very particular role.
Cohen says that this maneuver is unfair to kids because it doesn't allow them to develop as players or as individuals in life.
Because ultimately, the seasons where you really grow as a person are the seasons where you struggle. And you're engineering a system for your kid where your kid won't struggle and where your kid won't lose. And anybody who's been alive for more than a few decades knows that you only really get better and only really learn when you struggle and you lose. The winning is the treat, you know, but the winning is just a celebration. You never, as my father also said, you never learn anything from winning. You only learn from losing. And it's from losing that you really learn to win. And that, see, when you try to engineer hockey so that can't happen, you kind of destroy what is probably the main value of youth sports, or one of them, which is not getting better at the sport and not preparing to play college hockey or something, but learning how to be part of a team, learning how to play a role on the team, learning how to lose, and that losing isn't the end of the world, that you can come back from it and come back from it stronger and quickly.
And yet, he admits his own faults as well. As a parent, he's struggled at times to maintain his composure or see the silver lining after a tough team loss.
This is really hard, you know, like I'm always questioning not just my son so much. I feel good about him. The one I feel bad about is myself, you know, like why am I getting caught up in this? Why do I care? And am I doing an injustice to this person or that person? And then you realize that being a decent person is a really hard thing.
It can be hard to keep your emotions in check when you're as heavily invested in the game as many parents are today. But in the end, it's important to act responsibly and set an example of how to deal with life's curveballs.
I always say to my kids, like, you got to draw a line. Like, there's some things you won't do and some things you won't say no matter what somebody does to you. And not because you don't want to hurt them, because you don't want to hurt yourself, you want to be a good person. I just think one thing I don't want to get lost is how rewarding this experience is. And one of the best things about youth sports and all these things is actually the relationship with the other parents, because that's all my friends now.
You can read about the triumphs, the struggles, and the exploding popularity of kids' competitive hockey in Rich Cohen's book, Pee-wee's Confessions of a Hockey Parent, available now online and in bookstores. You can learn more about all of our past guests by visiting our website at viewpointsradio.org. For more behind the scenes and to support our show, follow Viewpoints Radio on Instagram, X, and Facebook. This story originally aired in January 2021 and was written and produced by Polly Hansen. Our executive producer is Amira Zaveri. Our studio manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Marty Peterson. This segment is brought to you by the Capital One Venture Card. Earn unlimited 2x miles on every purchase. Plus, earn unlimited 5x miles on hotels and rental cars booked through Capital One Travel. Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Viewpoints returns in just a moment.
$5 won't get you much food these days, even on a value menu. Unless you're at KFC. With the new taste of KFC deals, you can get a hot, juicy Drummond thigh, creamy mashed potatoes and gravy, and a flaky, buttery biscuit starting at just $4.99. Son of a bucket, that's a good deal. The new taste of KFC deals starting at just $4.99. It's finger-licking good. Prices, participation, and product offering may vary. Tax, tip, and fees extra.
The Radio Health Journal podcast gives listeners the latest news on what's trending in health, science, technology, and more.
Certainly, we all want to see suicide prevention, and I'm certain that it does work to a degree. It's when I hear that all suicides are preventable that it makes me bristle, because they are not.
Featuring medical experts who break down complex topics in a way that's easy to understand. Radio Health Journal podcast, available wherever you find your favorite podcasts and at radiohealthjournal.org.
This is Viewpoints Explained. I'm Ebony McMorris. Every 10 years, millions of Americans take part in the U.S. Census. The nationwide poll helps the government figure out how best to distribute trillions of dollars to places like schools, social services, public parks, and more. If you filled out a census from before, you may remember a question about race. There are several options to choose from, like white, African-American, Asian, Native Hawaiian, and more. These categories are socially constructed and change over time. For the Census Bureau, data on race helps to paint a better picture of the country and can help reallocate resources to better assist minority populations. However, considering the importance of this question, some feel it's still exclusionary. In 2022, nearly 4 million U.S. residents, excluding undocumented immigrants and refugees, identified as Middle Eastern and North African. Yet there's no clear category for this classification. That is until now. This year, the U.S. Census changed the race identification, adding Middle Eastern and North African as a category with 6 ethnic subcategories, including Lebanese, Egyptian, Syrian, Iranian, Iraqi, and Israeli. What do you think about this change? Are these divisions becoming too complex, or is it a natural and needed progression? The next U.S. Census is set to take place in 2030. That's Viewpoints Explained for this week. More in a moment.
Welcome to Culture Crash, where we examine what's new and old in entertainment. Richard Linklater is a miracle of a filmmaker. Originally known for his ultra-low-budget movies like Slacker and Dazed and Confused, he's been able to keep finding new lives and new identities as a filmmaker as he goes along. He made one of my favorite trilogies of all time, the Before series, with Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy telling the years-long romantic saga of Jesse and Celine. In 2003, he made a huge splash with School of Rock, a heartwarming studio comedy starring Jack Black. And his 2014 film Boyhood was filmed over an unheard-of 12-year-long shoot. Through it all, he's maintained a down-to-earth filmmaking style, an approachable Texas man who shoots movie stars in their best light and makes lovely little films that I can't get enough of. His latest movie is called Hitman, and it's now streaming on Netflix. It stars Glenn Powell, the charismatic force of nature you remember from Top Gun Maverick and Anyone But You. Powell and Linklater have teamed up before, most notably in Everybody Wants Some, a delightful movie about a 1980s baseball team that's been described as a thematic sequel to Dazed and Confused. But now comes Hitman, a sexy, funny summer smash of a movie about an awkward professor who finds his mojo working as a fake hitman for police sting operations. Over the course of his work, he meets a girl, he makes some questionable decisions, and plenty of plot ensues. But like all good Linklater movies, the plot comes second to the vibes. Hitman has great vibes. It's light and fun, even when things get tense, and it gives us a true leading man star performance from Glenn Powell, who just might be a certified movie star by the time Twisters hits theaters later this summer. So give it a shot. It's a fun little romp from one of our greatest living directors, and it's already streaming on Netflix, just waiting for you to hit play after a long day in the sun. I'm Evan Rook.
At Charmin, we heard you shouldn't talk about going to the bathroom in public, so we decided to sing about it.
When you roll the Charmin Ultra Soft on the potty, this is more so roll it back.
Charmin Ultra Soft is irresistibly soft and more absorbent, so you can use less. Enjoy the go with Charmin.
The Radio Health Journal podcast gives listeners the latest news on what's trending in health, science, technology, and more.
Why are certain providers and medical doctors not listening to family members who have lived through a disease path for such a long time?
Featuring medical experts who break down complex topics in a way that's easy to understand. Radio Health Journal podcast, available wherever you find your favorite podcasts and at radiohealthjournal.org.
And that's Viewpoints for this week. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram to learn more about upcoming shows and find a library of past programs on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. Plus, you'll always find previous segments and more information about our guests at viewpointsradio.org. Join us again next week for another edition of Viewpoints.
You're listening to Radio Health Journal, the trusted news source for medicine, science, and technology. I'm Elizabeth Westfield.
I'm Shel Lustig.
And I'm Greg Johnson. This week, the science behind manifestation.
People keep looking outside themselves to the universe or for some external magic that's going to change their lives. The power that they have in their own minds is far beyond what they can ever imagine.
But first, forced sterilization sounds barbaric. So why is it still allowed in America?
This so-called team won't let me go to the doctor to take it out because they don't want me to have any more children.
All that and more this week on Radio Health Journal.
So you just used bug spray in your home. Now what? Well, between the waiting and waiting for things to dry up and keeping your family away from the mess, it hits you. You could have used Zevo. Unlike other bug sprays that stick around, Zevo goes from kill to clean in seconds. Plus, it's safe for use around people and pets when used as directed. Zevo, people friendly, bug deadly.
Each week on the Viewpoints Radio podcast, you'll hear from our leading experts on an important topic within education, history, society, psychology, and more.
Building AI systems is like having kids. You want your kids to be smarter than you are.
You want your kids to be more successful than you are. And at the end of the day, you want your kids not to kill you.
Viewpoints Radio Podcast is produced by our team of award-winning journalists. Subscribe today by searching Viewpoints Radio wherever you listen to podcasts.
Just a couple of years ago, media outlets were working overtime to report on the rumors surrounding Britney Spears and her conservatorship. During a testimony, the pop star refused to mince words when she claimed that her father was forcing Spears to use birth control, an IUD, against her will. It's an accusation of forced sterilization, shocking in this day and age. But to a probate judge in June of 2021, she says it's true.
I want to have the real deal. I want to be able to get married and have a baby. I was told right now in the conservatorship, I'm not able to get married or have a baby. I have a ID inside of myself right now, so I don't get pregnant. I wanted to take the ID out so I could start trying to have another baby, but this so-called team won't let me go to the doctor to take it out because they don't want me to have children, any more children.
At the time, Spears was 39 and felt that her opportunity for a viable pregnancy was closing. So for her, you could argue that there wasn't much difference between forced use of birth control and permanent sterilization. Now, you might be scratching your head and wondering, isn't forced sterilization illegal? What many people don't realize is that in 1927, the U.S. Supreme Court sanctioned the forced sterilization of thousands of disabled, poor, and minority women without their consent. That case, called Buck versus Bell, has never been overturned.
I think even folks that maybe are not aware of this long history of forced sterilization or particularly shocked by that revelation, because it implies that there are people that are kind of controlling Britney Spears' reproductive choices. And I think in this day and age, people believe that women should have the right to make their own reproductive choices.
That's Natalie Lira, Associate Professor of Latinx Studies at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Her research focuses on reproductive justice and the history of medicine.
And so I think even divorced from this long history of sterilization abuse, it's a disturbing revelation. But add to that, this very long history of state-mandated sterilization that started with the eugenics movement.
Eugenics is a pseudoscience that became popular in the U.S. as an effort to implement genetic theories for the so-called good of society. The Nazis applied this same theory to its extreme during World War II.
Eugenics argued that certain social problems were caused by people who had defective traits. So they asserted that things like poverty, crime, immorality, largely the outcome of defective biology. And so by that logic, they asserted that if we could identify individuals and populations that produced these socially detrimental traits and prevented them from reproducing, then society would benefit. And so it was a science that really individualized or biologized social problems, and in the process really made reproductive control a legitimate facet of social welfare and public health.
One woman named Carrie Buck fought back. She argued that forced sterilization was cruel and unusual punishment and a violation of her Eighth Amendment rights. But in a 1927 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court wrote that, quote, the principle that sustains compulsory vaccination is broad enough to cover cutting the fallopian tubes. Buck lost her case and was sterilized, along with thousands of other women in prisons and institutions across the country.
The Supreme Court upheld eugenic sterilization as a legitimate policy, and Oliver Wendell Holmes was a judge in that case, Buck v. Bell, in 1927. And the assertion was that it was better to end the family line than to allow that there be three generations of imbeciles. I think the direct quote is, three generations of imbeciles is enough.
Though many organizations have fought back, only two states have banned forced sterilization.
Disability rights organizers did a lot of work to kind of make this practice unpopular. In kind of like the mid-20th century, forced sterilization was less systematically occurring. It still occurred in public hospitals and in private settings.
For example, between 1997 and 2013, the state of California forcibly sterilized 1,400 female inmates. Court witnesses claimed that it was cheaper to sterilize these women than to support their progeny on welfare. And in September 2020, 148 immigrant women detained by the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement were given what Lyra calls unnecessary hysterectomies without their consent.
So I wouldn't say that this has all ended. I think we have many examples where this still happens, and it's not as systematic as it was in the era of eugenics, but we see that people who are kind of marginalized and labeled in different ways and placed in vulnerable positions continue to experience reproductive abuse of all kinds, and even the most extreme kind, which is kind of this forced sterilization. And so, yeah, folks that are familiar with this history see what's happening to Britney Spears as kind of part of this longer legacy.
Unfortunately, I don't think the Spears case is an outlier. From my experience talking to people, working with people in conservatorships and guardianships, I think the most unusual thing about her case is how much attention it's getting.
That's Zoe Brennan-Crone, director of the Disabilities Rights Program at the American Civil Liberties Union. The Americans with Disabilities Act, signed into law in 1990 by President George H.W. Bush, is much of what's at issue. The ADA gives people with disabilities the same opportunities as everyone else. However, substantially impaired people living under a conservatorship or a guardianship lose their civil liberties.
There's very little data about conservatorships and guardianships nationwide, so we don't know exactly how many people have this authority, how many people use this authority, how it's being used. We don't have the hard data on it, but because it simply doesn't exist. But we know that this is something that happens, that when a person is put under the process is called a conservatorship in California, and it's referred to in most of the rest of the country as a guardianship. But in that process, the court is taking away the rights of the person with disabilities or perceived to have disabilities and giving the rights, giving the opportunity, the power to make choices about that person to another person. That's the conservator or the guardian. And very often that includes the right to make medical decisions. And that includes the right to make decisions about reproductive freedom in a lot of cases. And it's a really huge infringement on a person's rights and identity and autonomy, and unfortunately can happen with very little oversight.
Brennan-Crone contends that people under a conservatorship or guardianship should not lose their civil liberties and rights. She recognizes that many guardianships are supportive and loving, and that many guardians encourage the independence of their loved ones as much as possible. But that isn't always the case. Brennan-Crone believes that systematically giving one person power over another creates a dangerous situation. She'd like to see a reduction in the number of conservatorships in the U.S. through the establishment of a variety of support systems to help the disabled.
Supported decision-making is one of those ways. It doesn't have to be a family member who's doing that. It can be friends. It can be support workers. Part of the idea of supported decision-making is that it's really supposed to be many people who are working with you. So there isn't just all that power in one person. And even, you know, technology can make a really big difference also in helping people live and direct their own lives. Like, most of us have apps on our smartphones that help us live our own lives, right? Like, you have an alarm clock, or you can set a reminder to tell you to lock the doors at night, or you can all sorts of just sort of like simple things that you can put into place that many of us do already, and recognize that those are ways that can support a person living their own life.
Still, the decision to establish a guardianship is often a foregone conclusion. Brennan-Crone hopes to see the day when concerned parties consider the matter more carefully before going to court to take away someone's rights.
To say, okay, let's think about, you know, what does this person want? What do they need? Is there a reason that we think that this person can't direct their own lives? And in the case of adults, you know, I think that they're spending their money the wrong way, or getting bad haircuts, or drinking alcohol more than they should are not actually reasons to take away a person's civil rights, you know? And so I think really having a system where you really have to identify, here's what we think the danger is, the problem is, and really brainstorming what kinds of voluntary things. What if somebody agreed to have a joint checking account with someone they trusted, and so, or, you know, oversight in a checking account so that that person could put the brakes on if they spend more than, you know, a certain amount of money in one day and help the person talk through what they were doing. And if they choose to do that, if they can agree to that, then there's no reason to go through a court system and take away someone's rights.
According to the International Justice Resource Center, forced sterilization is a human rights violation. And yet, it's legal to enforce sterilization in the U.S. You can find more information about all of our guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org. This segment originally aired in September 2021 and was written by Polly Hansen. Our lead producer is Kristen Farah. Our executive producer is Amira Zaveri. I'm Elizabeth Westfield.
Coming up, how to manifest your dream life when Radio Health Journal returns.
At Charmin, we heard you shouldn't talk about going to the bathroom in public, so we decided to sing about it.
When you roll a Charmin Ultra Soft on the potty, this is most of roll it back, everybody. Charmin's irresistibly soft and hella nice. The crib is always stocked.
It's our potty.
Charmin Ultra Soft is irresistibly soft and more absorbent, so you can use less. Enjoy the go with Charmin.
Each week on the Viewpoints Radio podcast, you'll hear from our leading experts on an important topic within education, history, society, psychology, and more.
When you have lawmakers that create systematic policies that are really only set up to favor people with deep pockets, then you have the rise of corporate industry taking over.
Viewpoints Radio podcast is produced by our team of award-winning journalists. Subscribe today by searching Viewpoints Radio wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dr. James R. Doty has lived many lives. His students know him as an adjunct professor and director of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education at Stanford University School of Medicine. His patients are thankful for his expertise in complex spine surgery. And countless startups have benefited from his investments. But before Doty was a neurosurgeon or angel investor, he was a little boy living every day in a mental war zone.
I came from a challenging background. My father was an alcoholic. My mother had had a stroke when I was a child, was partially paralyzed, had a seizure disorder, unfortunately was chronically depressed, attempted suicide. We were on public assistance essentially my entire life. And oftentimes, and there would be trauma at home, fights, etc., I would get on my bike and ride as far and as fast as I could away.
It was during one of those rides that Doty found himself at a magic shop talking to Ruth, the owner's mother. She was one of the only people at the time that really listened and made him feel safe. Children who grow up in chaotic environments are often chronically stressed and anxious. Their sympathetic nervous system, which controls the body's fight or flight response, is always on, keeping kids like Doty in a constant survival state that further stresses the body. Seeing that this 12-year-old boy needed some guidance, Ruth invited Doty back each week. Doty learned the practice of mindfulness. It started with relaxation techniques and breathing exercises that helped him turn off survival mode and engage the parasympathetic nervous system, known as the rest and digest state.
And this is that place where actually we evolved to be, where we should be most of the time. And it's when our physiology, both our brain and our peripheral physiology, work at their best. And once I was able to attend and be present, then she made me realize that the negative dialogue that I had going on in my head was not truth. And so she taught me, instead of just letting those comments float by without attaching to them, she actually taught me to respond to them with positive affirmation. When I changed how I looked at myself, it resulted in me, how I looked at the world, and more importantly, how the world looked at me.
It was at this point that Ruth finally taught Doty the skill that would change the course of his life, the act of manifesting. The idea of manifesting